thanks so much for joining us. I saw the movie last week and I enjoyed it. I mean, it's such a gripping story on its own, but just to see how you did it too was also, I have so much I want to ask you, but when did you come across, did you just come across Felt's book or, you know, what inspired you to do it?
When he confessed to being Deep Throat, I was in Chicago and I called my agent and was desperate to write the movie. You know, I was a investigative reporter for the New York Times Magazine and others, and you know, Deep Throat and Watergate and All the President's Men was a living mythology for me.
Do you remember when you first watched All the President's Men?
No. I mean, I've watched it.
Do you remember when you first got asked that question today?
I've watched it dozens of times. Yeah. It's one of the iconic films with some of the iconic performances. The director is someone I admire enormously. You know, it's the knowable mythology of Watergate. It's not, yeah. It's just not entirely all true, and it's also not really the only way to understand what the story is about.
Absolutely, it's sort of when you're sort of making the pitch to get it funded. Is it sort of, hey, it's imagine All the President's Men, but from Deep Throat's perspective? Did you kind of sell it like that, or did you kind of say there's a lot more layers to this man, including his daughter? I mean, you explore a lot of layers of this guy.
Yeah, it's actually bears no relationship to All the President's Men. It's like saying Schindler's List is, you know, World War II, but from the point of view of, you
right,
know,
right.
from of the camps instead of, you know, where
right.
eagles dare.
I right,
mean, it's
right, right.
geographically, it's a completely different thing. Look, you know, Mark Felt was in the center of Watergate because all the information, the investigation landed on his desk and he didn't need to figure out what to do about it. And he was getting crushed and destroyed and compressed and the investigation was getting pulled. He was using reporters right and left. He was talking to at least four of them. Woodward is just one of them. You know, they published a book and, you know, had a great film made first. And so that became the standard bearer for the mythology.
Gotcha. Before we go too much further, remind our listeners who maybe they missed the story of when he actually came out, but remind them who Mark Felt was, like where his job was with the FBI.
Felt was the number two in the FBI during Hoover's last decade, but really was running it because Hoover got old and then
right, yeah.
ultimately died. And Felt was in charge of the entire bureau. I mean, he'd been in the bureau for over 30 years. He was a real company man and really believed in the bureau as the last line of defense and really believed in it as an institution, as a crucial piece of American democracy.
Talk sort of about that, because there's a certain, I mean, I think that's the driving force of the movie, is this guy's dedication that the FBI be its own entity, and obviously there's echoes of that today with Comey and everything else, but you know, it's the White House trying to, you know, put a damper on that investigation. You know, you must get it back to us in 2 days and then we want to move on from it. But talk about sort of how that's sort of the driving motivation for this, your protagonist, that, you know, that it's, he believes in the institution from, you know, from he's a principled perspective.
Yeah. Look, the U.S. government is a very complex but delicately designed machine. If the system is allowed to function, if the institutions are allowed to do their job, it actually works. There's checks and balances, good guys win, the bad guys get caught, corruption gets stopped. And all Felt wanted was for the machine to be allowed to do its job. Apolitically, look, he didn't like Nixon because he thought Nixon was corrupt. He thought the White House was manipulative. And he thought that they were trying to turn the FBI into kind of a personal KGB type machine. All he wanted was the FBI to be left alone to do its job and to find out the truth, right or wrong, and he succeeded. And when it was stopped, when the White House pulled the plug in the FBI's investigation, that's when he betrayed the FBI's code of honor of leaking information in order to save the FBI. So one could say he was a traitor, but a traitor in order to save the nation.
Absolutely. I mean, I briefly referenced it, but talk about how it's so timely into what's going on now.
Well, look, you know, the dynamic of David versus Goliath, of corruption at the top and integrity at the bottom, is enduring for a reason. It's we find this dynamic all over the place all the time. So, you know, someone said to me once that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
Yeah.
You know?
Is that a Mark Twain, I think?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's because human nature doesn't change.
Right. We're all the same. But I mean, I'm telling you, listeners, as you're watching this, I mean, if you're even slightly up to date on current events, you're going to, you know, as investigations are trying to get killed, and, you know, and it's just so many echoes. So I think it's riveting from a historical perspective, but also it feels like a very alive piece of work, too. So I appreciate that. You mentioned, ironically, Schindler a couple seconds ago, but talk about casting Liam Neeson. Was he always the guy you had in mind for that, or how did that come about?
There was a version 10 years ago when I started writing the movie that Tom Hanks was going to play, Phil.
Totally, could pull it off, too.
But Liam's integrity as an artist, his bearing, the characters he's chosen, his physicality, was really just perfect. He was the only person I went to, ultimately.
Some of his the most fascinating scenes are watching his face in the scenes where his higher ups at the FBI are trying to say, you know, one of you in here is the brat, and to see the sort of his face where he knows it's him and others around him kind of suspect it's him too. And just how do you coach Liam through those moments, or are there certain choices he's just making, or how did you actually play that?
No, we talked about it a lot. How to be a spy within your own shop and to lay covering fire by throwing other people under the bus. Look. His motivation was always about saving the greater good. There's no question he sacrificed others to do it. It's one of the reasons why the FBI doesn't like him.
Yeah.
But they don't understand the totality of his motivations and what he was up against and what he was really trying to do. I mean, directors, we don't coach actors, not the best of them, but we talk about character and scene and what we're trying to convey. You know, we make adjustments. I tell everybody I work with, if I'm reading what I need to read in the performance.
Yeah, absolutely. The best little, I don't know if it's an acting choice or if it was in the script, but listeners can't see, but I'm tapping the table. I love throughout, he does the little tapping with the pen. And you do actually wind up explaining it later in the movie, which I thought was cool. We talk about how the whole house of cards is going to come down. But explain to our listeners who haven't seen it yet what the tapping is.
No, that was the operating principle of the movie. It was written into the script, and it was I talked about it all the time with my cast and with Liam in particular. You know, if you tap on something long enough with the same rhythm, the molecules and electrons that make up that thing begin to dissemble and come apart. So if you tap on something long enough, meaning if you disrupt it, if you try and bring it down, if you interrupt it, if you just distract it, you can eventually destroy an institution, just like you can destroy a bridge by creating sort of an electronic chaos. And that's really what the film is about.
Absolutely. Diane Lane as his wife at home. Obviously, their daughter has gone off to, you know, a commune, because this is back in, you know, late 60s, early 70s. To me, it's like Mary Tyler Moore, Ordinary People. She even has that line that mothers don't hate their daughters, but in Ordinary People, she says, mothers don't hate their sons. I totally got that dynamic with Sutherland and her. But working with her and sculpting her as sort of the both of them, really, of explain how sort of, you know, he's got the Nixon stuff going on the surface, but I think it's a really cool sort of subplot, I guess, if you want to say, about, or even their internal motivation about their daughter and all the stuff going on with the, you know, the Weather Underground. You know, it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition there.
Well, you know, Felt wasn't just about Watergate. He was also a husband and a father. He had a very combustible, alcoholic wife who was really driving him and making life at home very difficult. And he had a daughter who he loved desperately, who had vanished and joined a counterculture, and he was terrified that she'd actually join the Weather Underground. And so I was interested as much in this man as a father and a husband trying to desperately keep his world together as I was about an FBI agent trying to do his job. You know, we're all multiple things at once, and our motivations are rarely just one thing, and I couldn't tell one part of the story without the other.
Absolutely. It kind of reminded me of in Mad Men when Roger Sterling goes to get the girl at the commune, his daughter. Talk about, I guess, more, let's say, visual kind of things. I like that early on you show, there's several scenes where you're kind of showing him pulling into his parking space in a parking garage, and it sort of sets up, you know, the foreshadowing of the famous deep throat shots we always remember from All the President's Men and everything we've read. Was that sort of like a motif of him pulling into those spaces? Or am I reading too much into it?
No, he was always the first one there. You know, if you noticed, when he pulled into the garage was empty. Because this is a man who, you know, if the agents had to be in at 7, he was in at 6.
Yeah. And then just visually, you and your cinematographer, there's sort of that, I mean, you can choose go anyways as a director, but there's sort of that bluish tint over the whole thing. Take me into sort of that choice.
Well, I wanted the movie to be really beautiful, and I talked to him about it. I used a blue filter almost over everything, because I wanted to create a subjective world for Felt that was beautiful and colorful, but still full of shadows. So that was a choice. That was very much a choice to create a colorful, saturated motif for the movie.
Absolutely. And then just talk about incorporating sort of the it's a really DC movie. You're driving around, you see, I mean, especially viewers here, we're going to react to it probably a lot stronger than even other places around the country. Just seeing the bridges and the monuments and everything they've seen.
I actually wanted to shoot the monuments in ways and from angles and directions we'd never seen them before. So if you noticed, Washington is shot usually through the window of a moving car from a subjective point of view, and through mundane, everyday Washington life. There aren't the postcard shots, not one in the movie.
Right.
They're always from the point of view of someone who would have been jogging across the bridge over the Potomac. There are shots of the Washington Monument, but through trees and fog. I wanted the Washington in the movie to be lived in and mundane and everyday and not magisterial.
Right, awesome. And then sort of take me into sort of how you decide to end on that freeze frame with him. You know, he's given the, you know, testimony, you know, years later in a different case, and he happens to, and he gets the question, wait, are you really Deep Throat? And it kind of freezes on him. Take me into sort of like how you decided in from a script level to end on that as opposed to, you know, years later in the 2000s when we actually all learned about it.
Sure. You know, I wanted to end on a moment that Felt himself had lost control, where he inadvertently confessed to being Deep Throat in the most unlikely of scenarios. He was being accused of and indicted for unconstitutional break-ins against Weather Underground, and he admitted to the prosecutor, who I know, inadvertently that he had been Deep Throat, and the prosecutor asked him, and then someone in the jury asked him. And there's actually quite a bit more to that scene that I cut, but I love the idea of ending on the moment just before he either says yes or no, as though there's suspense.
What got cut? Now I'm curious.
He said no.
Oh, okay.
And the prosecutor ran up to him and said, perjury is a Class A felony, and if you just perjured yourself, I'm going to convict you.
And it's decades later he does the Vanity Fair story, or how much longer?
Decades later.
Yeah, wow, that's crazy. Why do you think he held on to it for so long? Just for the sheer legal reasons, or?
Not at all. In fact, he would have been a hero.
Yeah.
He could have worn the mantle of hero for you. No, I think he did it because he did it for the right reasons. He didn't want credit, and he didn't want notoriety, and I think he felt a little ashamed at having betrayed the FBI's code of conduct.
Why do you think he finally did ultimately come out?
Because I think he wanted his family to be able to enjoy the legacy. And I think he knew he was toward the end of his life, and he had grandchildren, and he had a daughter who he loved, and I think that he wanted them to know what he as a man had done and left behind.
So then that's a perfect place to leave it. Just to wrap it all up then, what is that legacy of Mr. Mark Felt?
The power of integrity and anonymous integrity. You're able to do remarkable things, superhuman things, heroic things, but you don't have to wear tights or a cape to do it.